This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents How Women Rise. Break the 12 habits holding you back from your next raise, promotion, or job. Written by Sally Helgeson and Marshall Goldsmith. Read by Sally Helgeson and Marshall Goldsmith with Suzanne Torin. This book is dedicated to Frances Hesselbein, friend, mentor, hero. Author's note. The stories in this book are true, but names and some details have been changed. Part 1. On Being Stuck. Chapter 1. Where They're Coming From. In 2015, a mutual friend and colleague, Mike Dulworth, sent Sally and Marshall an email with the subject line, Crazy Idea. His suggestion? That they collaborate on the book that you are now listening to. They both immediately knew it was a great idea. Explaining why requires a bit of background. In 2007, Marshall published his international bestseller, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, How Successful People Become Even More Successful. There was a gold sticker on the front cover that read, Discover the 20 Workplace Habits You Need to Break. The lead endorsement came from Alan Mulally, then CEO of Ford Motor Company, CEO of the Year in the United States, and one of Marshall's superstar coaching clients. Marshall's proven improvement process rocks. In the book, Marshall identified 20 behaviors that often trip up high achievers in their quest to make it to the next level. These are habits he's repeatedly observed hindering talented people from reaching their full potential, diminishing their ability to inspire and lead others, and at times even derailing their careers. The examples and stories were drawn from the global base of clients Marshall has developed over many decades as one of the world's most successful executive coaches. A key insight in the book was spelled out in the title. The same behaviors that help people achieve high positions often undermine them as they seek to move further up. Because these behaviors worked in the past, people are reluctant to let go of them. On the contrary, many believe they are successful because of these bad habits. Any human, in fact, any animal, will tend to replicate behavior that is followed by positive reinforcement. The more successful we become, the more positive reinforcement we get. We can easily fall into the superstition trap, which is, I behave this way, I am successful. Therefore, I must be successful because I behave this way. Wrong. We are all successful because of the fact that we do many things right, and in spite of the fact that we are doing some things that actually work against us. Marshall wrote the book for a broad audience, not just leaders at the top of their organization's pyramid or ladder, but those on the middle rungs as well. What got you here is basically for anyone whose behavior gets in the way of where he or she ultimately wants to go. Since publication, Marshall has traveled the world sharing and developing the ideas he put forth in the book. But in the course of doing so, and especially while delivering a series of workshops for women based on his 2015 bestseller, Triggers, he came to recognize that some of the more aggressive and self-centered behaviors he identifies as problematic in What Got You Here are less likely to be stumbling blocks for successful women than they are for men. For example, instead of claiming credit they don't deserve, women are often reluctant to claim their own achievements. Instead of always needing to be right, women are more likely to be hobbled by the desire to please or the need to be perfect. Instead of refusing to express regret, women often can't stop apologizing, even for things that are not their fault. Everyone has self-limiting behaviors, for the simple reason that we are all human. But although men and women do sometimes share the same undermining habits, they frequently do not. Women often face very different challenges as they seek to advance in their careers and operate on a bigger playing field, so it makes sense that women would adapt their behavior in different ways. And women are often rewarded differently, as will be shown in the next chapter. These differences shape their expectations of what behaviors will be effective. Given that Marshall's coaching base is typically about 80% male, it's not surprising that the original habits in What Got You Here would be those that most often hold back high-performing men. Marshall didn't view these behaviors as particularly male when he wrote the book, but rather as common forms of self-sabotage that could be corrected using the insights and practices he'd developed as a coach. Yet the more he worked with women, the more Marshall saw that they could benefit from a similar approach that addressed different behaviors. Enter Sally. Sally has been working with, writing about, and researching women leaders since the publication of The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, in 1990. Because it was the first book to focus on what women had to contribute to organizations, rather than how they needed to change and adapt, companies began asking her to develop and deliver women's leadership programs almost from the start. As a result, Sally has spent nearly three decades helping remarkable women around the world grow their leadership skills and consulting with executive teams seeking to retain talented women. She has worked with some of the most successful women leaders in the world. This has given her both up-close exposure to the challenges women face, as well as plenty of opportunities to observe what gets in their way. The two of them knew each other well from the Learning Network, a small group for top leadership professionals that Marshall had started in 1996. But neither of them had considered collaborating on a book about behaviors that hold women back until that email with the tagline, "Crazy Idea." Because of their complementary experiences and long-standing friendship, they felt confident that by combining forces, they could provide specific, helpful, and targeted guidance for women seeking to advance to the next stage in their careers and heighten their ability to have a positive impact on their organizations, their communities, and on the world. Sally viewed the collaboration as a chance to help women address stumbling blocks that had held them back for decades. And Marshall saw a whole new world of habits that the coaching insights and practices he'd been honing for 30 years could help address. They had also each had aha moments that confirmed their belief that women could benefit from a book on behaviors that get in their way as they seek to rise. These personal experiences have made them passionate about the need for this book and convinced them of its potential value. Marshall's aha came while coaching the legendary leader Frances Hesselbein, who had coincidentally been extensively profiled in Sally's bestseller, The Female Advantage. Frances will be mentioned quite a bit in this book. During her long tenure as CEO of the Girl Scouts of the USA, Frances had gained international attention when no less an expert than Peter Drucker, the founder of Modern Management, wrote that she was possibly the finest leader he'd ever met, and suggested she be considered to head up General Motors. Upon retiring from the Girl Scouts, Frances assumed the presidency of the Peter F. Drucker Foundation for Nonprofit Management, later known as the Leader to Leader Institute. Frances has earned respect and kudos from corporate, military, and nonprofit leaders around the world throughout her extraordinarily long career, and received almost countless accolades. She has 23 honorary PhDs, was profiled on the cover of Business Week, and received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor accorded to American civilians. Marshall was honored to accompany her to the White House when she accepted this well-deserved recognition from President Clinton. Marshall had first met her when she was still with the Girl Scouts. He was doing volunteer work for the Red Cross, whose CEO at the time was a member of Frances's board and a mutual friend. When Marshall described to her the 360-degree feedback process he had developed to help clients become better leaders, Frances decided she could benefit from some coaching, and Marshall donated his time. As part of the process, he interviewed her board members, direct reports, and other stakeholders, and wrote up a full report. Not surprisingly, the feedback for Frances was incredibly positive. However, when she saw it, her immediate response was, "I have so many things I need to improve." She then began listing about 27 things she wanted to get right to work on. While Marshall was impressed by her dedication, he was surprised that a person of her stature was so self-critical. He knew that most of the high-performing men he worked with would have viewed the kind of feedback Frances received as a testament to their brilliance as leaders, as well as confirmation that they had little or perhaps no need to change. He was, unfortunately, aware of too many men who responded to negative 360 results by saying, "If I'm so terrible, why am I the most successful guy here?" Or, "I made $5 million last year, and you're telling me I need to change?" By contrast, Marshall recognized that his primary challenge in coaching Frances would be convincing her not to be so self-critical. In the years since, he's found this to be true with other fantastic women leaders. No matter how effective they've been, or how much recognition they've received, women often tend to focus on all the ways they believe they fall short. As a result, when coaching women, Marshall usually starts with a ground rule request. Please do not be too hard on yourself. So Marshall's aha was that successful women's tendency to critique themselves instead of others opens them to different behavioral habits than men, who are more likely to accept recognition and deflect blame. Sally's aha was more personal and painful, providing insight into a behavior that had helped her earlier in her career but was now getting in her way. By chance, it occurred when she and Marshall were co-delivering a half-day seminar for female engineers in Rhode Island. Sally's usual practice before big events was to spend huge amounts of time rehearsing her program and memorizing her talking points so she could deliver her program smoothly and avoid any mistakes. So she arrived in Providence early on the day before the event and stayed in her hotel room to prepare. Marshall arrived late, so they agreed to meet on the morning of the event when the client picked them up in the lobby. When the client arrived, Marshall, wearing cut-off jeans, immediately announced that he'd forgotten his pants and asked to stop at a mall en route to the venue so he could buy some khakis. The client obliged, and as they drove around, Sally marveled at how Marshall seemed to be taking the incident in stride. For her, showing up for an engagement without pants would have felt like a literal nightmare, given that she often had anxious dreams of finding herself on stage half-dressed. But Marshall took the attitude that since he travels a lot, stuff happens. At the venue, where 300 women were waiting, the only men's room displayed a ladies' sign and was awkwardly situated at the front of the hall where everyone could see it. Marshall paid a visit, but as he exited, he slammed his head on the inside purse hook. He wasn't used to one of these in the restroom, and tumbled out onto the floor. As he picked himself up, laughing, Sally again could not stop thinking how mortified she would have been if she'd made such an entrance. As the day proceeded, Sally stuck with her tightly prepared program while Marshall took a fluid approach. Super prepared, she felt an obligation to cover all her points and share everything she knew, while he engaged participants in spontaneous exercises. An hour before the event's scheduled end, Marshall's pager beeped. He'd gotten his departure flight time wrong, and now, suddenly, had to leave for the airport. He apologized, but said he knew Sally would do a great job of winding up the program. Again, her first thought was how horrified she would be if she'd miscalculated her flight time. As Sally soldiered on, participants leapt to their feet to give Marshall a standing ovation. some of the air went out of the room when he left. Reflecting later on the experience, Sally realized that her exhaustive preparation and need to plow through every one of her prepared remarks had not served her particularly well. Diligence and a willingness to work extremely hard had helped her when she was starting out as a speaker, but contrasting her own dutifulness with Marshall's spontaneous and forgiving approach made clear that her audience would enjoy themselves more and probably learn more if she were less driven by her desire to be perfect. Marshall had hardly been perfect, yet the audience loved him, perhaps because his somewhat bumbling behavior was obviously authentic and so gave them permission to be themselves. He not only articulated a message about the need to let go of mistakes, he demonstrated it in his behavior, showing how a highly engaged yet imperfect human could have an impact even when circumstances, the forgotten pants, the bathroom tumble, the misjudged flight, seemed to be working against him. By contrast, Sally seemed to be demonstrating what being hard on yourself looked like. You may have experienced similar aha moments when you suddenly see that behaviors that helped you get where you are now can hold you back from advancing to the next stage. Maybe, like Sally, you spend too much energy trying to be perfect, trying to please, or overvaluing expertise at the expense of relaxed communication. Maybe you struggle with speaking too much or too nervously, or letting details undermine your focus. Maybe you find yourself hoping to be spontaneously noticed and rewarded for your hard work instead of advocating for yourself. Maybe you put your job before your career in an effort to demonstrate loyalty, or fail to enlist allies who can spread the word about your achievements. If any of these behaviors are getting in your way, or you anticipate that they may do so as you move higher, please continue listening. This audiobook is for you.
Chapter 2. Where You Are. Where are you right now in your work and your career? Are you in a place that feels satisfying and gives scope to your talents? Are you valued not just for your contributions, but also for your potential? And do you feel your work is leading you to a place that will satisfy your ambitions and help you make the difference you want to make in the world? After all, you get to define what success means to you. You get to define what it means to rise. Maybe for you, it's moving to a higher, more lucrative position. Maybe it's finding a wider playing field or getting more recognition for your work. Maybe you want more say in the direction your organization will take in the future. Perhaps you want to create a new business or product. Maybe you want to instill a spirit of joy among your collaborators, customers, and clients. Or you're fired by the desire to help other women get ahead. The point is, your definition of rising is always going to be personal, individual to you. But one of the biggest impediments to rising is also personal and individual, being blind to the behaviors and habits that keep you stuck. As noted in the previous chapter, these behaviors may have worked for you earlier in your career, which is why you may be tempted to cling to them. But as you move higher and assume more responsibility, what got you here, wherever you are now, can begin to work against you. This is true for men as well as women, but in our experience, the behaviors that undermine women are often different from the behaviors that undermine men. Our focus on behaviors doesn't mean we seek to blame women who have not risen as quickly as they would have liked, or that we don't appreciate the role external barriers play in keeping women stuck. Impenetrable old boys' networks, sexist bosses, men who seem incapable of listening to women, or who claim credit for their ideas in meetings. career tracks that assume families do not exist, performance review criteria subtly designed to favor men, the unconscious biases that shape hiring and promotion. These impediments are real and unfortunately continue to play a role in stymieing women's advancement. Although women have made extraordinary and rapid progress in nearly every sector over the last 30 years, workplace structures and expectations created with men in mind continue to frustrate many women's talents and ambitions. So, we repeat, we are not trying to gloss over or deny obstacles that we know are real. However, our primary focus in this book is not on identifying external barriers or providing roadmaps around them. It's on helping you recognize the behaviors that get in your own way as you seek to become more successful on your own terms. After all, your behaviors lie within your control, whereas external forces like unconscious bias may not. If the executive your boss reports to only feels comfortable talking with men he meets on the golf course, trying to change that will be an exercise in frustration. If your company uses performance criteria that subtly penalize women, you can be a voice for pointing this out and work with HR to explore alternatives. But it's difficult to persuade your company to immediately jettison how it evaluates performance. However, uprooting an unhelpful habit, behavior, or attitude you've picked up over the course of your working life is the one thing that does lie within your control that can seriously improve your chances of success. At minimum, making the effort should improve your daily experience of work and better prepare you to reach your goals in the future. So think of how women rise as giving you the means to clear your path of self-imposed obstacles so you can become more successful and take greater satisfaction in your work. Our goal is to help you make the biggest positive difference that you want to make on the path you choose through life. How you define success. Before we get started, we need to clarify what we mean when we talk about success, a word we'll be using quite a lot in this book. In our experience, women often define success a bit differently than men. This means they also define success differently than organizations have traditionally expected people, primarily men, to define success. Instead of viewing money and position as the sole or even chief markers of success, women also tend to place a high value on the quality of their lives at work and the impact of their contributions. Enjoying co-workers and clients, having some degree of control over their time, and believing that their work makes a positive difference in the world are key motivators for many successful women. This does not mean women don't care about financial reward or position. Not at all. If women believe they are underpaid or feel their position in the organization doesn't reflect the level of their contribution, they will resent it. And this will certainly impact their commitment and their perception of success. After all, money and position are still the carrots companies use to reward people and recognize their value. And most of us work because we need or want money. However, one reason organizations sometimes struggle to retain high-performing women is that they operate on the presumption that high salary and high position will always be sufficient motivators, even if the quality of work life is consistently low. This assumption, especially when it comes to women, is often wrong. In fact, women are more likely to leave jobs that offer a high salary and position but a low quality of life. They often report finding such jobs not worth it. These are not wild generalizations. We are basing our observations on decades of experience as well as on hard data. For example, my colleague Julie Johnson and I joined with Harris Interactive, the polling company, to conduct a study of similarities and differences in how men and women perceive, define, and pursue satisfaction at work. The results appeared in our book, The Female Vision, Women's Real Power at Work. The survey, which was delivered to 818 men and women who held management positions in companies with more than 50 employees, found many similarities between men and women. For example, both men and women reported deriving great satisfaction from leading teams, posting results that exceeded expectations, and being recognized for their contributions. But the survey also indicated that men tended to place greater value on attaining a high position and earning a high salary, whereas women placed a higher value on the actual experience of work. Earning an excellent salary or achieving a top position did not feel as satisfying to women if they were also unable to enjoy their days. Not every day, of course, but enough to make the job feel worth it. Men not only tended to view position and salary as more important than women do, they were also more likely to judge themselves and others based on those measures. Marshall and I have both seen how this form of comparing can lead successful men to underinvest in key relationships such as family, friends, and community, even though these relationships have consistently been shown to be essential components of human happiness and satisfaction. Julie and my research also found that men placed a greater value than women on winning, viewing it as a significant source of satisfaction and a key marker of success. They enjoyed besting competitors, running up the score, and often assigned a numeric value or rank to their contributions and achievements. Women, by contrast, took less satisfaction in competition and scorekeeping, and often went out of their way to describe winning as the result of a collaborative endeavor, whereas men were more likely to describe themselves as playing to win. Women were more likely to agree with the statement, "I will pick up the slack for others to assure that a project is successful." Marshall's decades of experience working with successful leaders confirm these findings. He was interviewed in the Harvard Business Review and asked, "What is the biggest challenge of the many successful leaders that you have met?" His answer, "Winning too much." As Alan Mulally, one of Marshall's heroes, observes, "For the great individual achiever, it's all about me. For the great leader, it's all about them." The transition from achiever to leader can be particularly hard for highly competitive men who may have difficulty recognizing that, as a leader, their job is to make everyone else a winner. Women are less likely to struggle with this transition. Although many of the women we have worked with like to win, they tend to be less interested in winning for themselves than in helping their organizations or their teams win. This reluctance to view money, position, and winning as chief arbiters of success is psychologically healthy for women and great for their teams and organizations. But it can have a dark side, leading women to underinvest in their own success, even as they devote time to building up others. This instinct for self-sacrifice also lies at the bottom of a number of behaviors that hold women back. As you will see, the trick to maximizing your talents and opportunities is not becoming a less thoughtful and giving person, but rather being purposeful and intentional about your choices, while also addressing the behaviors that keep you stuck. The problem with stuckness. How do you know if you're stuck? Stuckness usually manifests in different ways that are nevertheless interconnected. You feel something is preventing you from moving forward or from leading the life you're supposed to be living. You feel unable to break through circumstances that are conspiring to hold you down. You feel as if your contributions are not recognized or appreciated. You feel the people around you have no idea of what you're capable of achieving. Stuckness can seem circumstantial, the result of your situation or the fault of someone who has power or leverage over you. This perception may reflect a degree of truth, but it's also helpful to consider the ways you might be keeping yourself stuck. After all, your responses help shape your circumstances, and your behaviors shape how others respond to you. That's why being able to identify these behaviors is so important. Consider the following cases. Case 1. Not being recognized for what you're good at. Ellen is a software engineer for a booming Silicon Valley company that has made a high-profile commitment to developing women. She's a talented engineer, but is also more outgoing, empathic, and socially skilled than many of her engineering colleagues. As a result, she's been able to build unusually broad connections during the 3 years she's been with her company. She describes herself as a go-to person, a fulcrum around which relationships form. Coworkers frequently email her with queries or requests for help. She connects them with other employees who might be helpful or with resources they need. This helps her be effective in her job and improves workflow throughout her unit. Her boss has frequently commented on how well things seem to be going. Because Ellen takes pride in her connectedness and sees it as an essential aspect of the value she provides, she was stunned when during her unit's annual performance review retreat, her boss made the point in an otherwise excellent assessment that she needs to get better known in the organization, have more of a presence, and more actively promote what the division is doing. "I couldn't believe it," she says. "The very thing I've always thought I was best at, and he's telling me I fall short." He even makes it the center of his critique. Having her efforts and skills go unacknowledged made Ellen feel unseen and undervalued, stuck in a thankless role working for an ungrateful boss. "I really felt hurt," she says. "How could he not recognize what I contribute?" It wasn't until a few months after the review, when she heard a career coach talking about the need to actively bring attention to the value you provide, that Ellen realized what had happened. "I saw there was a very simple reason he had overlooked my role as a connector. I had never told him what I was doing. I'd never mentioned all the people I connected with in the course of the day or the week or the month. I just somehow expected him to know. But he didn't monitor my email. He didn't stand at my office door watching who came in and out. So he had no way of knowing how many people I was in touch with. I was actually bringing a lot of attention to what our division was doing, but I had completely neglected to let him know." Ellen realized she had a problem with habit 1, reluctance to claim your achievements, and habit 2, expecting others to spontaneously notice and reward your contributions. Case 2, keeping your head down before building alliances. Carrie recently got a big promotion in her financial services firm, heading the high-profile risk assessment unit. Having come from investment banking, she didn't have much familiarity with the extensive regulations that navigating risk requires and felt a lot of pressure to get up to speed. The pressure was intensified by the fact that her predecessor, a former superstar in the firm, had made reckless decisions that resulted in government sanctions and was very publicly fired as a result. Eager to help restore her company's good name and reward the executive team's faith in her abilities, Carrie decided to spend her first 3 months learning everything she could about risk management and studying regulatory requirements. She felt she needed to become an expert on the topic so she wouldn't make any missteps. Once she did, she told herself, she could come up for air and start building the relationships that would help rebuild her shattered unit. But from almost the first day, she found herself inundated by requests for help and information she was not yet ready to respond to. The people in her unit wanted a clear sense of what she expected from them, and the corporate leadership team wanted to be kept informed. Carrie knew that there were people in the company who could assist her, but she didn't want to ask for support until she felt she could speak credibly about risk. After all, she had been put in charge, which meant she was supposed to have a clear idea of what she was doing. But Carrie's attempts to isolate herself in order to better understand her subject quickly earned her a reputation for being inaccessible and aloof. Her direct reports complained that she failed to give them guidance, while several members of the executive team feared she was withholding information, as her predecessor had. Finally, the CEO, whom she'd known for almost 20 years, called her into his office and asked what the hell was going on. He said he'd put her in the job because people trusted her, but she was somehow managing to squander that trust. Carrie was forced to recognize that she'd fallen victim to habit 3, overvaluing expertise, as well as habit 5, failing to enlist allies, from day 1. Case 3, overcommitting in an effort to please. Miranda is a senior associate in a thriving global law firm that has grown rapidly through a series of mergers. She regularly lands top assignments from the lead attorney who heads commercial law, her field of practice, and sees the potential to build a solid career in the firm. But she knows that in order to rise, she must be active on a few essential committees and get to know partners in the firm's widely dispersed offices. So she jumped into the effort with both feet, volunteering for leadership positions in both the Women's Leadership Network and the firm-wide network for native Chinese speakers. She also signed up for the committee planning the firm's global partners meeting, though it quickly became apparent that immersing herself in details of invitation design, though it's something she enjoys and is good at, was hardly an efficient way to meet firm leaders. Balancing these commitments with a sudden increase in the number of commercial cases going to trial proved challenging, but Miranda prides herself on being a glutton for work. So, when a fellow senior associate in a practice recommended she co-lead a new initiative examining recruiting practices in the firm, she leapt at the chance. The work required traveling to various offices to interview recruiting teams, which she figured would give her a chance to become more visible. But her first trips made clear that she would mostly be meeting staff people to hash out administrative details, rather than chatting up hiring partners as she'd envisioned. It was interesting work, but Miranda quickly realized she was being stretched to the breaking point. As her litigation practice heated up, she reluctantly decided to let go of the recruitment commitment, but worried that the colleague who recommended her would be disappointed. She approached him with misgivings and was surprised when he quickly agreed that the project required a lot of work for uncertain rewards. "If that was so," she asked, "why did he recommend her?" "Oh," he replied nonchalantly, "I was way too busy to do it, and you seemed like someone who would basically say yes." Miranda realized she'd been tripped up by Habit 8, the disease to please. Habits. Ellen, Carrie, and Miranda are all talented, hardworking, smart, and ambitious. They've chosen careers and companies in which they have the potential to rise. They've also managed their personal lives in a way that has enabled them to advance in their careers. Each one of them is, in Sheryl Sandberg's great phrase, leaning in. But they've also let the habits they developed at earlier stages in their careers get in the way of being able to move to the next level. For example, Ellen's first engineering job was at a startup led by a famously self-promotional lone wolf, where she benefited by never singing her own praises or talking up what she was doing. However, she now works in a very large company in which every division must compete for airtime. In these circumstances, her established practice of not wasting her boss's time by talking to him about what she's achieving ends up working to her disadvantage. Similarly, Carrie's nose-to-the-grindstone approach won praise when she was an investment banker and was the chief reason she rose more quickly than her fellow trainees. But her new position requires leadership skills more than dogged work or subject matter expertise, which means she can't put off developing relationships or neglect those who look to her for guidance. She was chosen for her new position because of her reputation for integrity, not because she was an expert on risk. By not engaging people in her unit who have specialized knowledge, she signals that she has problems trusting others. This causes others to wonder what she has to hide. Finally, Miranda's eagerness to please was viewed as loyalty and devotion during her early years at the firm. So the lesson she took away from her rapid promotion to senior associate was that saying yes is the way to get rewarded. This caused her to overlook the extent to which her commitments need to be strategic. By willingly volunteering for something that didn't really serve her interests, she allowed herself to be taken advantage of by a colleague who was sharply mindful of his own strategic path. Each offers a great example of how extremely dedicated women can benefit by understanding how they sabotage themselves. Each played an unwitting role in her own stuckness. Autopilot. In addition to feeling situational, stuckness can feel deeply embedded. As you become habituated to certain behaviors, you may start assuming they are intrinsic to your character, part of who you are. So if you hang back from an opportunity because you dislike speaking before large crowds, you may rationalize that you've always been this way, even in grade school when you were among the last to raise your hand. If you're uncomfortable talking about your achievements during a performance review, you may recall that your mother always said that only selfish people talk about themselves. This is why approaching change from a purely psychological perspective can be daunting. You have to work through all the layers and experiences that have habituated your responses. This is a time-consuming exercise that can be paralyzing and often requires professional guidance. But approaching behavioral change by substituting new habits for old ones is empowering. It's also something you can do on your own without help from a therapist or coach. After all, you probably have had experience tackling bad habits in the past. Maybe you smoked as a teenager. Maybe you used to munch on popcorn whenever you watch TV. Maybe you didn't really listen when people were talking, but let your mind wander instead. Maybe you were always 5 or 10 or 15 minutes late. As you discovered, if you were able to overcome such habits, they were actually not aspects of your character, nor were they reflections of the real you. They were simply ways of showing up in the world to which you had grown accustomed, behaviors that had become your default mode. Most habits get started for a reason. Maybe you were looking for a way to cope with stress. Maybe peer pressure was involved. Maybe you wanted to tune out situations that felt overwhelming. The thing about habits is that they tend to hang around even when the conditions that got them started no longer exist. That's why spending a lot of time trying to figure out why you do them is usually not the most fruitful approach. You do them because you've done them repeatedly over time. They become your go-to responses, unconscious and routine. In other words, your habits are not you, they are you on autopilot. When you're on autopilot, you're not really thinking about this situation, this moment, this challenge, or the specific response it requires. You're just reacting in a way that has become comfortable for you over time. Your brain saves a lot of energy this way. You expend fewer mental calories, but you're not really present for what you are doing, which is why you are not considering whether your behavior is serving you now. It didn't occur to Ellen to give her boss the details about how she was connecting with people in the company because she'd gotten in the habit of not talking about herself. Keeping her head down had become her go-to response. Carrie did not question her efforts to position herself as an expert because studying hard and mastering her subject was how she'd always handled new challenges. She felt uncomfortable when she didn't know the answers. Miranda never paused to consider whether saying yes to a colleague who made a suggestion would help her get where she wanted to go because she was so accustomed to saying yes. The words seemed to fly out of her mouth before she had a chance to consider the pros and cons of the suggestion. Each of these women was using an old template in new circumstances and managing to stay stuck in the process. Unstuck. To get unstuck, to let go of a behavior that is no longer serving you, you need to first of all recognize it as a habit. You need to bring it to conscious awareness so you can begin to try out new responses and see if these get you different results. This can feel awkward and even dangerous. It can make you feel vulnerable, foolish, and exposed. But we have seen it work. Hundreds, even thousands of times over many decades. When it does, it unleashes energy and confidence. And that energy makes it easier to stay with the effort. Ellen. Once Ellen got over her hurt and realized that her boss did not see her as a connector because she had failed to let him know, she was able to swing into action. She decided to email him a brief note every Friday morning for 3 months, listing all the people she'd talked to and noting how she'd been able to help them. She didn't tell him what she was going to do or ask if she should do it. She just went ahead. She says, "I felt ridiculous at first. I kept thinking, he's busy. Why should I keep bothering him to talk about myself? I felt self-serving, sucking up a lot of airtime to continually make the point about how connected I was. When I didn't hear back from him, which was usually, I wondered if he was sending me a message that this wasn't useful. But every once in a while, he'd shoot me an email saying, 'Good work,' and that kept me going." At the end of the 3 months, Ellen and her boss had their quarterly meeting. As she entered his office, he came forward to greet her instead of remaining at his desk, as was his habit. The first thing he said was how happy he was that I was letting him know who I was keeping in touch with. He said it was important. It was information he needed to know. He told me my connections were strengthening our team, which meant I was strengthening him. I'd never thought of it in that way, but I realized it was true. Carrie. Carrie's big wake-up call came when her CEO confronted her about how she was losing people's trust. "I felt like resigning right then or going off to hide in a hole. It killed me to think that I'd let him and the board down. Instead, she found the strength to suggest that she get him a few bullet points about how she planned to change, and get him those points by the next afternoon. I had no idea I was going to say that, but I knew it was the right response. He's a can-do guy with a short attention span, so explaining why I'd gone wrong was beside the point. He would want action, which meant getting him clear, strong bullets immediately instead of a well-worked-out plan at the end of the month. She started by jotting down everything that had gone wrong, not censoring herself, just letting it flow. As she read through her notes that evening, a couple of themes surfaced. She saw how frightened she was of not knowing answers to questions that, in fact, she had no way of knowing. And she saw how this fear had caused her to hide from the very people who could help her, instead of enlisting them as allies in a common effort. The bullets she sent to her CEO took the form of a targeted list of names, people in her unit with expertise in various forms of risk, whose views and judgments she planned to solicit, sometimes singly, sometimes in a working group. It felt uncomfortable and a little late in the day, but I figured I had nothing to lose. If I went down, I would go down with my head up, asking my team what they thought, building relationships, because that's what I'd been hired to do. It worked. Miranda was so shocked when her coworker came right out and admitted he'd volunteered her for a thankless task because, "You seem like the kind of person who would say yes," that she considered complaining to him or even telling her practice head. But then she realized he was only articulating something that was actually true. She was someone who could be counted on to say yes, even when it did not really serve her interests. "I'm the one who put myself in that position because I'm such a people pleaser, which means I'm the one who has the power to change it." Although she felt awkward, she immediately let the hiring committee know that her caseload made it impossible for her to continue with her volunteer role. She then did something smart. She decided to practice a new behavior. She asked a good friend, who worked in a different part of her firm, to spend 5 minutes a day asking her to do things that she would then say no to. "I hardly knew what no felt like in my mouth," she explains. "I associated it with being uncooperative and self-centered. So I had to get comfortable with the idea that I could be a good person who could be clear and say no when I needed to." These sessions turned out to be so helpful and so much fun that Miranda and her friend decided to make them a regular practice, scheduling time to work on new behaviors and then holding each other accountable for making change. Ellen, Carrie, and Miranda each discovered that changing specific behaviors could lead to changed outcomes, outcomes that increased the likelihood of their getting where they wanted to go. By recognizing the role they were playing in their own circumstances and identifying the specific behaviors that undermined them, they were able to make changes and get themselves unstuck. Chapter 3. When Women Resist Change. So if you recognize that you need to change in order to move ahead, why is changing so hard? Because resistance is a powerful force. If you've ever struggled to stay on a diet, incorporate more exercise into your daily routine, become a more patient and engaged listener, or just be present for your moments instead of letting your mind constantly rush ahead, you know what it's like to battle the demon of resistance. And make no mistake, resistance is a demon. It keeps you from having the life you want and imagine for yourself, at work, with your family, with friends, and in regard to your health. That's why learning to recognize and work through your own resistance is one of the greatest favors you can do yourself. Two factors are at play when you resist making changes you know could make a positive difference in your life. First, there's the simple physiological fact that your entire neural system is designed to favor the path of least resistance, the path you've created by your prior thoughts and actions. When you repeat behaviors, you establish neural pathways as if you're wearing grooves in your brain. This practically guarantees that you'll think or act in a similar way next time. Those established pathways are the reason that changing familiar behaviors is an uncomfortable experience. Basically, your brain tries to fight back. It sends urgent signals that you're missing familiar cues. Hey, it's 3 p.m. Why aren't you eating something sweet? Hey, that fragment running through your mind right now is more important than what the person you're talking with is saying. Hey, aren't you supposed to be feeling like a victim? Ignoring these signals requires neural energy and constant focus, which is especially hard when you're dealing with a lot of demands or trying to accomplish something. So you give in to the familiar signals. Okay, I'll just have half that donut, even though doing so only strengthens the neural pathways that keep you bound to the habit you are trying to break. Compounding the difficulty is the fact that you also invent rationales for continuing behaviors that have become comfortable or have served you in the past. If you reach for the sweet, you promise yourself you'll start dieting tomorrow. If you keep interrupting someone instead of listening, you tell yourself that they need to hear what you're saying. If you go down the self-pity rabbit hole, you wonder why the other person has chosen to attack you. All of this seems plausible until you consider that giving in to familiar signals today means that they will be back to haunt you tomorrow. All you've done is given your established behaviors 24 hours to become more entrenched. Successful people are particularly skillful at coming up with rationales to continue workplace behaviors that no longer serve them for the simple reason that these behaviors seem to have worked for them in the past. After all, they've received a few big promotions and gotten some excellent feedback over the years. They feel relatively on track. So if it's not broke, why try to fix it? In What Got You Here, Marshall shows how resistance is often rooted in what he calls the success delusion, the belief that because you have been successful, not only do you not need to change, you probably should not change. Because if you do, you might lose your advantage. As a coach, Marshall most often sees resistance to change manifest in three stages. In stage one, the person decides that whoever is suggesting he needs to change must be confused. In stage two, the person begins to recognize that, while the general suggestion about change might be valid, the critique does not apply to him. If it did, why would he be so successful? In stage three, the person simply attacks whoever suggests he needs to change something about himself. He just blames the messenger. This enables him to continue buying into his own rationales. Marshall has grown accustomed to seeing this pattern. But most of the leaders and powerful people he works with are men. So the question we need to ask is whether this pattern of resistance is also typical among women. Of course some women react this way. Women, as we all know, are not all alike. Neither are men. Gender is only one factor in determining how each of us responds to feedback, observations, suggestions, and critiques, to any evidence that we might need to change a behavior. That said, women often have very different experiences at work and may evoke different responses from those they work with. What they say is often heard differently or not at all, a phenomenon popularly known as speaking while female. They may carry more responsibilities, especially at home. They may define success differently, as we have seen. So it's hardly surprising that women's resistance can surface in distinctive ways. Ways that can keep them stuck, but can also give them a springboard for moving forward. Let's go back to Ellen in the last chapter, the fast-tracked Silicon Valley engineer whose boss gave her low marks during her annual performance review because he didn't perceive her as well-connected